welcome once again to another episode of The Wall Behind and Beyond. I am your host, Philip A. Jones. Today, we have a show guest who is an attorney and a journalist who served as a First Amendment litigator representing journalists, activists, and artists in free expression. He has received several awards for his work and even taught privacy law at UC Berkeley, in particular courses on the intersection of media and social change. Please welcome our guest, Jeff King, to the show. How are you today, my brother?
I'm well. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we want a phenomenal show, and we got a phenomenal guest. So I wanted to get straight to it because, you know, the listeners are really going to eat up every single thing you say because you're talking the things that people need to know. So the first thing I have for you is, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Absolutely. So I grew up in Vallejo, California. Lived here the first 22 years of my life. I went to Vallejo Public Schools. I went to Diablo Valley Community College, and then transferred to Berkeley and ultimately ended up at Stanford for law school, after which point I became a First Amendment litigator. And then transitioned into teaching also worked in international human rights before founding Open Vallejo and Informed California Foundation in 2019. I was basically spending more time at home because my mom was sick and was reminded of how amazing this community is and started to see some of the issues with the police and the government firsthand as well as an adult. So my background's in civil liberties, civil rights, advocacy, but fully made the transition to journalism and editing, primarily investigative journalism, in 2019.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. You know, opening it up, letting people know where it all started. My understanding is that you are an attorney who both practiced and taught civil rights and journalism law. Can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory and what led you into the journalism field?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. I was always journalism adjacent. I went to school because I wanted to be a public interest lawyer. I did that. I was a First Amendment and open government lawyer, mostly at small nonprofits and small firms for the early part of my career. So I represented activists, artists, journalists. Then again, I started teaching in the media studies department at Berkeley, where I had actually been an undergrad previously. When I was in law school, I did my first summer at this summer internships. So I did my first one at the Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution for the Senate Judiciary Committee under Senator Feingold. And my second summer, I split between a big firm and the ACLU of Northern California. And then I went for my fall term. I was a legal extern at the Federal Public Defender in San Francisco. And so always was interested in First Amendment and civil rights and civil liberties issues. And again, I was a litigator for a while at these small public interest firms. Eventually made my way into international human rights, where I also worked in a press freedom capacity, also did that in a volunteer capacity with, for example, the Society of Professional Journalists, Northern California chapter, did a lot of advocacy around journalists being unlawfully detained by police, for example, or retaliated against. Was seeing some of the things that were going on and thought that I might be able to put some of those skills to use, particularly because of two factors. One being that the press freedom environment was so hostile to truth-telling here in Vallejo. I was seeing neighbors retaliated against, harassed, people speaking up, people being engaged, people being aware, but it seemed actively being repressed at times. And so I figured my civil liberties background could help with that. And then also just my open government background in terms of prizing some of these records out of the government, which was trying to keep them under wraps. So it's a relatively direct trajectory, but I never planned to be a full-time journalist. It just happened.
That's excellent, and I think it's amazing that all the work that you've been doing and how you've been staying engaged, because in this climate that we're now in, people seem to have a problem a lot of times with the truth if it doesn't, support their interests. So I love that, and we say we want a free society, you know, we want things to be transparent, but sometimes when you report these type of things, especially these issues, inner city issues or race trajectory issues, you get a lot of pushback from people saying, you know, they don't want you to report or that you're not telling the story right and all this. So I'm glad that we need more people like you that's doing this work and looking into these type of specific issues. So thank you so much for that.
Appreciate it.
So what prompted your decision to start a nonprofit news source in Vallejo?
Yeah, so I trace it back to, there's kind of two versions of the story. The short answer is when the Vallejo police killed Willie McCoy on February 9th, 2019, six officers surrounded his car. He had fallen asleep in the driver's seat in the in a Taco Bell drive-thru, and the officers said things that included, I don't even want to give him a chance. He allegedly had a 40 cal handgun in his lap. One officer, more senior officers on scene, said, if he reaches for it, you know what to do. And ultimately, they were shining, 400, 500 lumen tactical flashlights in this 20-year-old's, barely 20-year-old's, face from inches away. And of course, he stirred in his sleep. He reaches up, he scratches his left shoulder with his right hand. They scream at him for 3 seconds and fire at him for 3.5. They fire 55 Jacket hollow point rounds into this young man and kill him. That for me was the moment when I just, it was too much. The slightly longer version is I was spending more time here, and there's a viral incident or an incident that went viral with a different police officer named David McLaughlin. He had gotten into an altercation off duty in Walnut Creek. He had also detained a young man named Adrian Burrell, who thankfully survived the encounter and went on to become, he already was an incredible artist. They ended up at Stanford Documentary School and is just doing amazing things. He's sort of he's been described as the Gordon Parks of our generation. I mean, he's absolutely incredible artist. And Adrian was filming a traffic stop from his own front porch, and this officer comes over and allegedly gives him a concussion. And so this all went viral because KTVU, Channel 2 News in the Bay Area, did a good job of covering it. And just a neighbor of mine asked online, what are they going to do about this officer and how much is this sort of thing costing the city? And I said, well, I don't know what they'll do about the officer, but let me spitball this other question, get back in the napkin analysis. You know, found some public records that showed the amount of the civil rights settlements and was shocked to learn how high they were, millions upon millions and millions of dollars. And not long after I responded, and I got an email from the city attorney, not a deputy, the city attorney herself, makes a lot of money, asking me what my sources were on this. And I had footnoted this social media response to my neighbor. It was on Nextdoor.com. So it was a response to a response to a post by somebody else. And I get this email from the city attorney taking issue with it. And before I can respond, I get a very long email from the city attorney basically trying to dissect and discredit the things that I had written. She called it an article. At that point, it was just a social media comment. She's arguing with a guy on the internet, sort of in a one-way fashion. And that email copied the police chief, city manager, city council, their staff, and it was just one of the more bizarre things I've ever encountered. And so that sent up a bunch of red flags. A few days later, I went to a town hall by a new council member named Hakeem Brown. I tried to ask a question to him about the settlements. He was very hostile to that. We later learned that he had a history of pretty extreme domestic violence and he ran for mayor. Didn't know that at the time, but he just seemed very hostile. And that night is the night that Willie was killed. And so that's why, in part, it was such a final straw. I'd been, just in the span of a couple of weeks, had encountered just enormous and weird pushback from these public officials, and it just didn't make sense. These were not hard questions. I mean, they're hard questions in a broad sense, but I was asking pretty straightforward questions, I felt. And then Willie was shot 38 times, shot at 55. And at that point, I thought, you want a news article or write a news article? And so at that point, took the post that I had done, did more research, found out the city had lost its insurance that it had for 31 years because of the civil rights settlements, and published it as our first piece.
Thank you so much, man. That was a very powerful answer. Speaking of Willie McCoy, this is so sad, man. There shouldn't be any partisanship in these kind of stories and issues. This should be a collective outrage. Without knowing the facts, it seems that they shoot first and then they shape their narrative later. Police, in my opinion, should be public safety people, not community enforcers. Back on the other side with Jeff King, we're getting into it. It's heating up. This is a great interview. You mentioned a focus on open government and press freedom. Why are these important focal points for you?
Ultimately, and I think this should apply no matter what one's political ideology, the power of the government is derived from the people. And it's the people who the government is supposed to be working for the benefit of, for all people. And the people have a right to know. There is this really great language, and I can actually pull it up. It's the preamble to California's Brown Act, which requires open meetings. It's government code 54950, and this is the preamble. This was written in the middle part of the 20th century. In enacting this chapter, the legislature finds and declares that the public commissions, boards, and councils, and the other public agencies in this state exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. It is the intent of the law that their actions be taken openly and that their deliberations be conducted openly. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people, in delegating authority, do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so they may retain control over the instruments that they have created. I mean, it's pretty good, right?
Wow.
And it's, yeah, and it's almost radical. And it was written, you know, in the height of the Cold War. That is a fundamental, foundational part of our representative democracy, I feel.
Absolutely. And if they could remember this in these government agencies and these other leadership responsibilities in local government as well as federal, if they could remember these, what you just read, if everybody recorded that and displayed that before they tried to stonewall or, you know, prevent the people from knowing what's really going on, stop trying to cover things up, just be transparent and we'll have a better society. So what do you find are some of the most challenging aspects of reporting on government agencies?
We are dealing with one of those today. I think the challenges involved in reporting on government agencies are extensive. I think it is it is particularly difficult in a place like Vallejo, in a place like Solano County, which has lacked investigative reporting for so long. I mean, I didn't intend to become an investigative journalist. I sort of tell people I agonized over this decision. If something else were just as effective or more effective, watercolor, you know, crochet, Aikido, like whatever it is, I'd be learning that instead of, you know, Associated Press style of writing dates and, you know, web design, things like that. But the truth is, actually, to borrow a phrase from our North Star, I.W. Wells, the way to right wrongs is to shine the light of truth upon them. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with government agencies that have not had to deal with that for a long time, I found that there are two things. There are challenges and opportunities. The challenges are they don't always follow the law, including when you tell them exactly what the law is. So today we're dealing with several agencies where an officer who admitted to having his badge bent, which was our first investigation, that Vallejo police were bending the tips of their star-shaped badges to mark fatal shootings. An officer, when he was in Vallejo, who had his badge bent, got into a shooting, a chase and a shooting in January. He's now with American Canyon Police, so chased this young man into Vallejo and shot him, and thankfully everybody survived. That is very clearly disclosable, the footage, audio, all of that. And we're actually having to sue the Solano County DA's office for records in another shooting, but now this is coming up, for audiovisual records. And Napa Sheriff, American County Police are Napa Sheriff's under contract. Napa Sheriff's office wants to give us, you know, everything they can. They've given us everything they can. But they're telling us that the Solano DA's office won't even turn over footage, the only footage that actually shows the chase and the shooting and what really happened. They won't even turn it over to them, let alone us. And so the law is very clear on this. It's a 2019 transparency law. And in my opinion, Solano County DA has just declined to follow it, which is why we're suing. But I said there's an opportunity. There's opportunities there too, right? Which is, I do believe that there are a lot of fair-minded, decent people in all over the place, right, including in government service. And what this ultimately does, if you form professional relationships around shared values of, you know, kind of what I described from the Brown Act, what I read from the Brown Act, ultimately, when people do get fed up who are in these positions to help out, you know, they leak all sorts of stuff to us. And they help and they tell us things. I mean, we never would have known about the badge bending had somebody very brave, and I obviously can't go into detail, but very brave and with a sense of decency, had they not come forward. And then, you know, we worked for 9 months to prove that up. So there's both challenges, but there's also, you end up kind of in the same moral space as people who have access to information and want to share it.
Yeah. Hey, you said a lot. It's deep. And as you were talking, I was just seeing everything because it all starts to come together. You know, human nature says that there's always going to be good and bad actors in every human being. You know, so the thing that makes people believe that because someone has on a uniform that automatically, without question, they must be a righteous person, it's kind of so antiquated in thinking to me, because anyone can put it on. The value of it is what you uphold. And, you know, when you're bending over badges and tips and all that, that's clearly a mindset of, you know, you're taking more of an interest in harming than you are in helping. So what do I know, but I'm just saying it's just the way it comes across, you know.
Well, and just to comment on that, I was actually talking to somebody today about this. We held open some space. I held open space for the possibility that that particular ritual, as odious as it is, could have in part been about, or could have meant to some people, or could have actually been about primarily the idea of getting through a traumatic event, sort of a shared trauma bonding experience. That's ultimately what legal counsel for these officers said. I think the evidence shows that there were, you know, parties and drinking, and it was. I mean, even that is bad, even if the intent is not so insidious. But I think that a lot of the evidence shows that it was pretty celebratory after these killings, unfortunately.
Sounds to me like the same measuring stick that they use when they talk about gang members, to be honest. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, we gotta keep sounding the alarm. That's all we can do, and keep reporting on these issues. So thank you so much for what you do. Again, what do you see as some of the greatest threats to press freedom as it stands?
That's a really good question. I think in the United States, one of the greatest threats to press freedom is actually market forces. This country used to have a robust press corps, and it does not anymore. There are newspapers closing every week. And what we see is that not only do you have a lack of information, you have information deficits in communities where that's happening. Again, it's happening to communities all over, all the time. The newspapers are closing. But what the research shows is that you also see heightened division and partisanship and a sort of everything that flows from having a lack of agreed upon facts, agreed upon, you know, perhaps empirically verifiable reality. And so, or a testable reality. And so what it ends up doing is it increases kind of partisan radicalization. It decreases trust in the press. Journalists are much more, they're stretched very thin oftentimes, you know, mistakes happen. And at that point, it's easier for bad actors, authoritarian actors, to take advantage of that. You know, when we were working on the bad story, when I was working on the bad story, I got some very specific threats. And I think I know exactly who they were from. Specific, very concerning threats. And the second we published, it stopped. And at this point, while again, I have to be careful here, it's a lot of people talk to us, and they're not all Boy Scouts, right? Mm-hmm. And going from threats to so many people trusting us has been a pretty wild trip. But I think that those things happen too, that kind of intimidation. I think with us, they just quickly realized that wasn't going to work, and it was just going to kind of harm them, kind of blow up in their face. But I think that those things are real, and I think that people are emboldened by both the decline in news media and people not having as many readers, not having circulation, and then also, you know, obviously the rhetoric from certain political figures about the media, about the truth, that's certainly extremely concerning.
Hey, man, I see it myself, and I'm sitting inside. The internet, the social media, anybody can put out anything. Anybody can be a journalist. They just get to putting out their point of view, and automatically it's taken as Bible. But when leaders discredit the media, you know, they're basically impeding information and enlightenment. And then they turn around and say that the media is the enemy of the people. I thought enlightenment and information and awareness and truth was what the people needed, not to be told that, you know, it's a discredited organization, or that should never be something that people can do in a free society, because once people start questioning these things, if you believe in the leader, then you believe the lies that they tell. So we gotta be careful. And it's just, you know, this is stuff that we never used to have to worry about in America. You know what I mean? This was all around the world, but now it's starting to hit us here, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, when I worked in international human rights around press freedom issues in authoritarian countries oftentimes, or working with and on behalf of journalists in authoritarian countries, you know, this reminds me, Vallejo in particular reminds me more of the work I did at that time than when I was a civil rights, civil liberties lawyer. You know, journalists getting threats, civil rights lawyers getting threats, that kind of thing, activists. So, you know, we just have to keep reporting. And one of the things we did with the badge bending story is we put the threats right in there. Mm-hmm. We quoted them. And in fact, that was a really bad move by whoever threatened us, because they provided the first example of what it really meant. It was not about getting through a traumatic event, they said. It was about celebrating killing. And
wow.
They should be aware that was very helpful for us, despite the fact that it was couched as a pretty serious and criminal threat.
Wow. Man, well, you know, I'm glad that you're, you know, bringing this to our listeners, because, you know, they will really appreciate hearing these things, because sometimes they make you feel as though these are all made up things. This is not possible to be the case. Here it is for you right here. You know, we got somebody in the business who is telling you straight up and showing you that this is what's going on. So what is your goal with Open Vallejo, and are you planning to expand the nonprofit model to other areas?
Yes, we are. So Open Vallejo is intended to be a permanent investigative newsroom for Vallejo, because this place needs it, right? Solano County needs it. But there are a lot of places that need it. Basically, every place needs investigative reporting. Vallejo has a hometown paper, Vallejo Times Herald, but they don't do the sort of investigative stuff we do, and we don't do a lot of the stuff that they do that keeps the community connected. I mean, a lot of our work is, you know, frankly, fairly depressing and serious. So the idea is, over the next year or so, we want to expand to all of California. And so Open Vallejo is part of the Informed California Foundation, which basically founded at the exact same time. That's the actual parent nonprofit. And the idea is not to franchise a bunch of Open Vallejos and go into Redding or Kern County or Compton or, you know, Butte and say, we're here to come help you fix the issues in your community, because we're not the experts, right? But frankly, it'll be kind of ineffective and offensive. The people who are in those communities, and communities across California, are the people who know their communities, who have the legitimacy that they've earned. I mean, a lot of why we're effective is because I'm from Vallejo, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to Sacks Hot Dogs across the street from the high school when we had off-campus lunch, that kind of thing. Like, I know the city, having grown up here. And so the idea is instead to take what works, what's working for us, because we figure Vallejo can at least be sort of representative, and then try and distill it into technologies, toolkits, methods, modalities of journalism and transparency that can then be taken by folks in other nonprofit newsrooms, civic organizations, you know, really anybody with an interest in government transparency and the truth, and utilize those things in their own communities. So I'll give you an example. Right now we're working with an organization called Muckrock to help us build something called the Vallejo People's Archive. And one of those things is, we're actually working with a bunch of partners. One of those things is we are scraping public records online and running optical character recognitions on them, et cetera, so that there is a separate independent archive of public records of what the government is doing. We're working with the State Library in UC Riverside to digitize old Vallejo newspapers, 2 dozen of them, going back to the mid-1800s, and trying to get a historical arc that literally goes almost back to slavery in terms of timing. And that's important in part because a lot of the reason Vallejo is so diverse is the Great Migration and people moving from the South to work in the shipyards, moving away from the Jim Crow terrors of the South, finding some here. But we want to better understand and help the laymans better understand the historical arc and how Vallejo got to be the way it is. And so we figured that's a good pilot project for them trying to do that across the state. And that's just one of the things we're doing. We want to do a People's J School, potentially, to teach journalism standards. I mean, I wish I'd had that. Standards and ethics and style. We are, legal trainings, how to get public records, how open government law works. And so we just want to lower barriers to entry and kind of make it so people don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Back on the other side with Jeff King, let's pick up where we left off. I have a great question, and I think, the listeners would really want to know. So I'm going to get straight to it. As a journalist and an attorney, what role do you think the media should play in reporting about collateral consequences of long-term incarceration? And is this tied to over-policing and blank checks and how law is being enforced in these inner cities and these communities of marginalized people?
I think the short answer is yes. There are structural systemically racist structures that are responsible for how policing is done in this country. Again, I think that you can't ignore the role of slavery in and the line that can be drawn between that and modern policing. That said, you can't just blame systems. I mean, there's individuals who are voting in these laws. I think that journalism needs to, at its core, do a better job of understanding that. I can't say that I'm perfect at that myself, or I know even a fraction of what I need to know. But when I go back and look at coverage, for example, of the Vallejo Police Department, which we've now shown marks fatal shootings with badge bending, and in 2021 illegally destroyed evidence of shootings linked to badge benders while we were still seeking it. And they knew, the city knew we were seeking these very records. And the senior city attorney was involved in that illegal destruction of evidence from those cases. We've, even after everything we've shown, you go back and you look at some of the coverage that preceded our more investigative coverage, and it's often just kind of the police press release version of events. And so I think that the media has, in particular since the murder of George Floyd, started to question police narratives and at least not present them as whole cloth. And I think that's really the fundamental responsibility of the media, is to always question, always try and dissect and just ask and find out what as close to the truth is as one can. And in saying that, I think one of the reasons that we've been successful with our reporting is we have built a level of trust and at least a grudging respect, even with people in the law enforcement community, as well as people in the impacted by police violence, because we will always call those guys for comment, right? We know they're not going to talk to us. We know they can't. They could get fired. But we'll always call, we'll always ask, we will always hear them out if they want to talk to us, even, on background. And we will test them, test their assertions, test the government's assertions, but we'll also take into account what they're saying, trying to get to the bottom of that and find kind of what's really going on, as, the early Mac Dre album was phrased. And that I think the media could do a better job of, but again, I don't want to criticize too heavily because this is all we do, right? We don't have to cover the daily stuff. We don't, you know, cover sports. All we do is investigative work, and there are these resource constraints. But also, you know, our resources are constrained, and it's a choice as to what we focus on.
Yeah, well, it's a balancing act, you know what I mean? We need the people that's reporting and investigating, and we need the people that's out there trying to uphold the law. We're just saying that it got to be a healthy balance. That's what we're saying. We're saying that you have to have a good intention. That's what we're saying. We're not saying, oh, they're all bad. That's just a cliche. But anyway, that last question I was asking because, you know, I come up in the inner cities of Baltimore, Maryland, and I've been locked up since I was a teenager. But every encounter I ever had, whenever I saw a police car, I would automatically go into this, you know, paranoia or this feeling of, oh, they're coming to do something. They're going to jump out on me. This was trained into my psyche. So my reaction was always looking as if I was doing something when I really wasn't. So they would jump out or chase me or pick me up and throw me on the ground and put the cuffs on me and realize I have nothing on me. And so I think that we get traumatized in the city by constant interaction with law enforcement, and we don't get the chance to see them as people who are here to do their jobs and make sure the community is safe. But we start to seeing them as people who are coming to get us. And so we need to, you know, books have been written on this kind of stuff, but we really need to understand, because they get defensive when we talk about our experiences. But we're not here. It's not about being critical and all of that. It's about saying, this is my experience. Do you understand why? And so once we start breaking that down, I believe that we'll have a better discussion like we're having right now. And so I thank you, man, and I appreciate you for coming through. And for listeners that's hearing you, how can they keep up with what you're doing, and how can they follow you? And is there any way that they can get a hold of you or look up your stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is just openvallejo.org. So open and then VALLEJO. We're OpenVallejo on Instagram, TikTok, you know, Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever you call it, want to call that one. But it's just openvallejo.org and then openvallejo on social media.
Man, absolutely. Thank you for a great interview, man, and a great show. But we will be here. If you need anything, just let me know. But I appreciate you coming on, and take care.
Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you.